So some of what we did today already is what in Vajrayana we would call preliminary practices. This is the ways of sweetening and enlightening, conditioning the mind before we sit to practice. So before we sit in meditation, in I think it's Sutta number six. I think it is. I'll just give you, I'm not going to read it, but I'm going to refer you to it. You can read it in your own time. Oh, no, Sutta number eight. It's effacement, and I always refer to it. If you've been at a retreat with me before, then you know that I'm going to reference it. The sutta is called effacement, and effacement, and this whole talk is about rubbing out self, the rubbing out of self. And so he says meditation is good. Meditation is very good, but he said, I don't call that practice. In this suit, and in other places, he has called it practice. That's why I say you can't get hung up on a word. You have to know where, you know, what it's referring to right, get the right shading, the right meaning, the right application. And so in this particular sutta, he doesn't call meditation practice. He said he calls that merely a pleasant abiding here and now. But what he calls practice is our attitude of mind, our speech, and our behaviors, our actions, right? And he says, now here, effacement should be practiced by you. Others will be cruel, but I will not be cruel. This is how effacement should be practiced. Others will kill living beings. I will not. Others will lie or speak falsehoods, but I shall abstain from false speech. Others will gossip, but I will abstain from gossip. Others will be covetousness, but I shall not be covetous. Others will hold wrong views and tenaciously and release them with great difficulty. I will not hold wrong views, and when I have, I will release them easily. Others will be of wrong speech. I shall be of right speech. Others will be of wrong livelihood. I will be of right livelihood. Others will be overcome by laziness, but I shall be free of sloth and torpor. Others will be doubters, but I will go beyond doubt. Others will be angry. I shall not. Resentful. I will not. Contemptuous. I shall not. Insolent. I will not. Envious. I will not. Avaricious. No. Fraudulent. Not for me. Deceitful. No. Arrogant. I shall not be arrogant. Difficult to admonish. I shall be easy to admonish. Effacement should be practiced like this. Others will have bad friends. I will have good friends. Others will be negligent. I shall be diligent. They'll be faithless, but I'll be faithful. They will have no fear of wrongdoing, but I shall be afraid of wrongdoing. We'll be shameless, but I shall be shameful here. Now, this kind of shame is not like how we ordinarily think of shame, but it means that when you're having a conscience, it means having a conscience, know you're doing wrong. I watch some of these, I guess you could call them shows on TV. It's the news. They made a show out, shows out of them, you know, but I watched one yesterday, and this guy's just put out a book, and in this book, he's shamelessly lying. I mean, we were all here a year or 2 years ago. We saw what he did. We heard what he said. We witnessed his actions. But now he writes a book that says he didn't do any of those things. You know, just no shame. That's all. That it means in that kind of way. And others will be of little learning, but we will apply ourselves to great learning. Others will be lazy and we'll be energetic. Others will be unmindful, we'll be established in mindfulness here. Others will lack wisdom, we will attain to wisdom. Others will adhere to their own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty. We shall not adhere to our own views or hold on to them tenaciously, but shall relinquish them easily. You mentioned that one three times. It means we must have a problem with that. Yeah. But effacement should be practiced thus. I say, even the inclination of minds towards wholesome states is of great benefit. So what should be said of bodily and verbal conduct conforming to such a wholesome state of mind? So he talks about, and that's just page 1 and 2. Three of that sutta. This is a pretty long one. So it's 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 pages long. I mean, he really talks about so that we really know what it takes to rub out the self, how to enter into a state where one is not the center of everything. The center of the world, center of the universe, center of their life, seeing everything from a me perspective. And you'll start to know, like, oh, that's Panyavati selfing. You'll start to know yourself in this way. The more you spend time out of yourself, but we can't like just drop out of ourselves in meditation. First, we have to really know ourselves, know our positioning, know where we are in a dark room. And know where the door is. Otherwise, when we start moving around, we start bumping into things. You know, or we may even be too paralyzed, too afraid to move. And so in the Vajrayana, we have what are called preliminary practices. Oceanic mind essences. I love, you know, some of this flowery language. It puts, you know, like a picture in your mind, the oceanic mind essence. So now you think of ocean, you know, like just oceans are huge. It's a lot of water, a lot. They're vast, they're wide, they're deep, they're very powerful and fierce. Nothing can stand against water. And yet you can like just run your hands right through it. How could something so not something have such a terrific force? But if you think about water, I mean, even thinking that we, I don't know, it's 80% water. We're mostly water too. Now, even in our physical body. But suppose our mind could become that supple. I have a great respect for water because I drowned. And that's why I also know that there's something beyond life in this body, breathing through, experiencing through this physical body. But after that experience, I've had a great respect for water. And so whenever I read anything about water, it was a challenge for me, you know, because of that drowning experience. And I had to develop something that would allow me to look beyond the word water and all the images that would come up for me of water and how terrifying water, the thought of water could be for me. And yet here I'm doing this practice, the oceanic mind essence, you know. So the emphasis for me was on the fierceness. And I had to develop a fearlessness to be able to engage the fierceness of something that is without limit, that's so expansive. And thinking that our mind, that's moving more towards what emptiness is. It's fathomless. It's broad. I mean, you know, the Buddha said himself, he said, I don't know everything. I mean, we talk about him being omniscient, omnipotent, all-knowing, and blah, 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 blah. But that's not what he said about himself. I mean, we have misunderstood it in a certain way. He said, I don't know everything. He said, but anything that I turn my mind to, that I can penetrate. So now, if you can turn your mind to anything and penetrate, you don't need to know. You don't need to know everything, you know. You don't. And so it's not how much Dhamma we learn, you know. At some point, then you got to learn something. If you want to read books, you know, you have to learn your ABCs. So it's not that we don't learn anything. But at some point, you know, when's the last time we thought about our ABCs? We don't. We have developed just the using those symbols and how they represent things until it's just like automatic thing for us. And this is how the Dhamma can become for us if we really understand it and if we really enter into it. If we're constantly checking to see how we're blending and melding with the Dhamma, you know. And so we normally in a Mahamudra, great mind seal, is how we cultivate a vast mind. We even think of equanimity as boundless generosity. You know, something equanimity kit also. I've seen people who say they're being equanimous and like they're just being detached. They just don't, you know, just don't care. They have just dropped it. And we have to be careful of not slipping in that way, you know. So how do we have the utmost care for others, the utmost concern for others, and at the same time cultivate equanimity? You know, how could we be in a place of comfort, a place of ease? People say, don't you see what's going on in the world? Didn't you hear what I said? She did to me. And they can't find this equanimity because it's more like a boundless generosity, a boundless offering of yourself to others until you just completely give yourself away. Not in a way that allows one to be taken advantage of and used, but as you walk, if you tread that path, you understand how to give yourself away, how to divest yourself of yourself. And it's simply that you leaves your mind. That's all. But it's a gradual thing. And nobody from the outside can be pointing you towards saying, you should be this, you should be concerned about that. You should, you know, whatever my pet project is, that should be your pet project. It's not in that kind of way. But it's a way, again, about coming to know oneself. And so there are these preliminary practices that we do before we, quote, meditate. The first thing is having a great regard for the Dhamma, for listening to the Dhamma particularly, you know, and this was an oral tradition. And there's something about listening, you know, if you're really listening, without being defensive, about the mind thinking, just listening, you know. So whenever I teach my classes, I don't entertain questions. Not unless, you know, I'll give a Dhamma talk. You can go listen to it two or three times. Then you can ask questions. But until then, you can't ask questions because you're thinking of questions while I'm talking. You know, you can't. I mean, you're missing half of what I'm saying because you're thinking about what I just said. And I ask you to just listen. That's the way my master taught us. said that we had to listen to a Dhamma lecture 7 times before we could ask a question. You know, because each time we listen, we hear more. And every time we listen, we hear something we didn't hear before, because automatically our mind started thinking. And so we missed something, you know. And so by hearing lectures like this, we can establish correct views, and we can eliminate, you know, the views that we hold on to tenaciously in our mind, that we don't even think we're holding on to them. We think about life just common sense, or I have this question or whatever. But he's telling us, just listen and listen and listen and listen. Then if you have a question, you can ask a question. But in this way, we establish our right understanding, and we can see thoroughly our own unwholesome characteristics, those that are not compatible with correct cultivation. And so he would tell us that the merit that we accumulate, you know, the good force in motion that we accumulate from listening to Dhamma is even greater than what we would accomplish in our sitting practice, if that sitting practice is not informed by something, not informed by the Dhamma. And of course, you know, we have to carry out what we listen to and say we understand and agree with. But what we're doing is we're gradually beginning to understand certain principles contained in the Dhamma that will affect how we view it, that will affect how we interpret what we hear. So we have to go through that time, that period of learning how to allow the Dhamma to inform us. I like infect. That might be a little hard for you to infect, but I want it to infect me, you know, or maybe disinfect me, but I'll just use inform for you. How to allow the Dhamma to inform you. And in time, then its principles will be your conduct. Its principles will be your speech. Its principles will be your thought. And then what happens is you'll hear something and you won't have to flesh it out. Suddenly it like rings true. Suddenly it sounds true because you have positioned yourself in a way that you can receive it when it comes. You know, so it's not as much doubt or I don't know, or well, what about this? And then then you're on a smooth ride. You'll be so excited. Every day it's like looking to see what the Dhamma's gonna teach me today. That's how I feel, you know. And in every situation you may be going through, you'll still be doing the same thing. You'll be looking to see how the Dhamma is, I'm gonna take a peek at something. Hold on 1 second. Okay, I wanted to say something, but I can't say it right now. So remind me that I wanted to say something this afternoon. Okay. And so this has something to do with the principle of initiations. And initiation is really not a lot more than the Dhamma being introduced to you through someone who has experienced or who understands experientially that Dhamma that they are sharing. And when that comes across, there's a certain kind of power. I like the Christian word that's used. Well, I guess it's not Christian. Maybe it's Greek, but it's dunamis. And it's an explosive kind of power that shatters ignorance. Oh, I know, maybe we could call it insight, couldn't we? If we could have an insight. We got a Buddhist term too we could use. But an insight has a certain kind of most strong power that shatters, you know, a heretofore ignorance that we possess. And so as we're getting ready to sit in meditation, the first thing that we do is recognize that the mind is limitless. And I'm not talking about the brain in our head, but that this boundless consciousness. And so at least that's taking us into the second, past the first four material jhanas, into the immaterial realm and expansive consciousness. That's why I tell you, you can leapfrog some of this if you get the right understanding. You know, you can write in cursive longhand. Now you can do shorthand. Right. And then you can even use in the courtrooms, they have these stenographers and they, write down everything that's said. And it's much faster than longhand is what I'm saying. And so when you have a teacher who has developed qualities through direct experience, it has a certain impact. It has a certain power upon you if you can receive it. If you don't receive it or can't receive it, then it's useless. I don't care. So when somebody tells me, oh yeah, well, I don't know, I'll just say the Dalai Lama was my teacher. Well, so what? You know, it's about what you have, or in church we used to say, so-and-so, who's your pastor? That's the first thing you say when you meet somebody. They don't even say hello, like, who's your pastor? You know, but we can't have our claim to fame based on who our teacher is. It's great to have a great teacher, but if we are entering into and receiving the transmission, then that will show up in our lives, is what I'm saying. And you'll start to experience things directly. And it will be off the pillow, because that's where non-self is cultivated. Then when you sit down on the pillow, you can enter into those states, into those realms that I read about in Sutta number 120, and you enter into them easily. It's not any striving that's necessary on your part. It's just that you have strung your instrument to a certain pitch and you're able to be on that frequency. You understanding me? Is that okay? And so the first thing we do is we tune our instrument. So I'm looking at how my mind is inclining. I'm training my mind. I'm wishing everyone blessings. I'm wishing everyone longevity and prosperity. I'm wishing everyone to not be separated from their happiness. And of course, I'm thinking about your happiness is not destructive to somebody else. You know, so don't ask the question, well, what if what makes that person happy hurts that person? No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about, you know, just wanting the best, wishing the best for people. When we have those kind of what abouts and what if questions in our mind, that's usually related, if we'll go a little deeper, to because there's some things that I don't want to have to stop doing right now, you know, and we can always fold it inwards, and it tells us something about ourselves. It's not just the mind thinking about the well-being of all beings. It's about my mind thinking that something I don't want to give up, something I don't want to do. We can just keep it right here, contained in this stinky skin bag. And if we get used to doing it that way, you know, the minute something comes up, a question comes up, we will reflect inwardly. He's constantly talking about turning the light inward, turning the light of the Dhamma inward, turning the light inward so that we can really see ourselves and really know ourselves. And so we're doing that constantly as part of the preliminary practice. Then the next thing that we do is we start thinking about life, you know, and And again, with this soft way of holding life, life is like a dream, you know? We will all die, you know? And then there will be the results, the karmic results of how we have lived. And I think of comment, I'm not confused. There are ways that we can think of it in a psychological way, but it was clear that he was talking, and maybe we can apply it psychologically because that'll help us to straighten some things out. But then he was just speaking, you know, he talked about after death, the dropping off of this body. You can call it a mental body if you want, but I think he was talking about the physical body. Because Dharma means phenomena, it means things, you know? We call the Buddha's teachings the Dharma, but it's the explanation of things. That's what it means. Like, that doesn't sound as great as the Buddha Dharma, you know, the explanation of things, you know? But that's, if you could understand it in that way, then you'd see that every action, every occurrence, every event is a dharmic event. And we'd be more circumspect in our movement, how we live and move and have our being in the world. You know? And then we'd also recognize that we can practice at any time, sitting, standing, lying down, that actually everything we do, we are practicing something. What am I practicing in this moment when I'm listening to something that causes, I have a dear friend and he happens to be in an occupation that involves, gigs and clubs, and they have alcohol and they have women in a certain mindset, and also the energy of men in a certain mindset. And he goes there and performs, and he's trying to do something useful and helpful. I'm like, you know, if you can go there and do that, I mean, the Buddha himself would go to parties, he would go to weddings, he'd go to great festivals, but he wasn't going there to get down. That's where the people were. And he said, I'll go there. There may be someone who's ready to hear something else. And he'd go there and he'd scan the room and he'd find someone and he'd go up and he'd have a conversation. And next thing you know, they're traipsing out the door with him and they've gone off to the forest somewhere. So if I say I'm going to those places because I want to give them, you know, the Dharma, make sure that that's what you're really doing. If you're saying you're doing something for a reason, make sure that's the real reason. And make sure that you have the skills, you have the development, you have the cultivation. Otherwise, you're gonna end up with them doing what they're doing. But this helps us to reflect and to be clear about what we're doing and how we're doing. Now, that's maybe an extreme case. But it could be like just going to the water fountain when people start gathering, you know, because, you know, you're going to hear some juicy gossip. I used to go to the water fountain when I had a job because I know whoever was not at the water fountain was going to be talked about. You know, so I'd go to the water fountain too, but I say, I'm not going to talk about anybody. And then they mentioned something somebody did. And I remember she did that to me too. Next thing you know, I'm talking about it too. And one day, I realized that habit, that pattern. And I stopped right there and I said, you know what? I'm gossiping and I vowed that I wouldn't do that anymore. Excuse me. And I went back to my desk and sat down. Now, I can tell you they had many conversations about me at the water fountain, but did I care? No, I did not care because I had suddenly become aware of myself, self-aware, you see. And it's wonderful when we start becoming self-aware. It says that when we start becoming self-aware, then we start realizing the shortness of our life and that there's nobody to save us but ourselves. We have to save ourselves. He points the way. Many of the great teachers, they point the way, but like we have to travel the territory. We have to save ourselves. So I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about these things. I must save myself. And then I start going over in my mind what it is that I hold to be true, what it is that I believe in. And then I start looking at myself. What did I do today in line with that? You know, what did I do today? What kind of karmic offenses, you know, did I commit? What good things did I do today? And I start wishing myself long life so I have enough time to get it right. You know, when I'm sure I have it right, then I can go for less time. You know, I was like, a sister's ready to jet up out of here. But until that time, I'm going for long life. So I have a chance to be all that I can be, you know. And I'm thinking about how wonderful it is that I discovered this path. I was telling my Buddha master that one time, and I said, you know, I'm so glad because I had been introduced to him 15 years earlier, and I wasn't down for what he was talking about. I just wasn't ready, you know, but 15 years later, I was ready. And as I started studying with him, one of the few Westerners who could get, you know, to him because he had millions of disciples. And I was like, and I'm so thankful, you know, that he waited for me. And then one of the high level monks said, he didn't wait for you. He didn't wait for you. It's just that you cultivate, you're here because you cultivated, you know, yourself. Otherwise, it wouldn't even be possible for you to be sitting here in his presence. So we have to know when we do things, you know, what it means for us. And that's how we get out of this feeling that a lot of us have that we're so unworthy, oh, I'm so unworthy, or this feeling that we have that we, you know, of needing to measure up to somebody else's standard, or can't see the goodness in ourselves, just off balance. Nobody says, get on balance. Know what your good is and what your not good is. You don't have to tell everybody, you don't be like a confessing Susan going around and telling, because that just actually reinforces the sense of self. You know, when you have to tell everybody things, you know, especially when you have to tell everybody about the bad things, because that's your way of being, good is like, you know, confessing, you know, so not in that kind of way. Sometimes we do need to share something with someone because it helps us to like step into the truth of it. You know, we get to lay it down. And that's why we should be a good listening ear for one another, and why we have to be faithful in holding these things and not thinking badly of them now that you know, so that's how she is. And, you know, so are we faithful in that way? Can we hear like a terrible thing about someone and don't run off in our mind, you know, like regurgitating, rebuilding it? But can we hold them? Can we really hold them? Can I hold you? These are the mind states of the Buddhists. So if we want to attain awakening, we want to have the mind states of the Buddhas. And so from that, we start thinking about how a Buddha thinks. Now we're talking about mind seal, right? How a Buddha thinks. And when things come to your mind as you're sitting there, how would the Buddha think about this? So I'm opening up not to how I will evaluate what comes up in my mind. Oh, that's bad. That's good. That's ugly. I knew she was like that. I'm not going to let that bother me. You know, but how would a Buddha think about that? You know, when fear arises, what would a Buddha fear? You know, the only thing a Buddha to be fears is wrongdoing. And because he fears wrongdoing, he abandons wrongdoing. And then there is no fear. He can win, he can lose. He knows that all goes with the territory. Are you like that? Can you know that you can't always win? It always cracks me up when you see two athletes, like two boxers or something, or you know, or two teams, and they're both praying to God, you know, to let that they can win. You're like, I'm your son, and let me win. Like what? You got a son and a what? You know, and so it's not in that kind of way, but we start thinking how would a Buddha think? Well, the one who has maybe the most skills, not necessarily the one who's most at ease, you know, not necessarily the one who has the most skills and yet who is most at ease and whose vision is not thinking about something that's weighing on him someplace else. So he's got focus, he's got mindfulness. But see, but the bottom line is that the answer is never a pat answer. It's an amalgamation of what you have put together with your own mind and with your own heart. That's why each one of us is the owner of our own karma. And so one really continues to devolve in this kind of investigation, you know, and wishing the best for everybody, even our enemies, especially our enemies, especially who we would call our enemy, because to have an enemy, you know, is something in our mind. This person may do something against me, but it's not really necessarily because he's my enemy. He's just doing what he thinks is expedient for him. And it goes against what I need or what I want, you know? So we have to redefine these words that we so commonly and flippantly use when we really get serious about our practice. And in this way, we'll start being so discriminating. In the beginning, with a little bit of discrimination, it's a good thing. But then discrimination becomes judgment. We find ourselves judging everything. He says, okay, now you got to let go of the hindrance of knowledge. And listen to these simple things that I tell you about doing all this good in this situation. What is good? What would be helpful? What would be useful? What would be beneficial? That's all that's being required of us. And so this takes away all of the street creds we could get by being able to know Pali words and, you know, with no hand signals, you know. And I know plenty of them, you know, but if I'm not walking my life out in a certain way, it doesn't matter how many hand signals I do. So when he talks about not relying upon rites and rituals, it doesn't mean we don't have any. Some of us have a ritual of getting up in the morning, washing ourselves, brushing our teeth, and making our bed. You know, is it bad? We do it every day without fail? No, actually, it's a good thing, you know. So he's not saying there's anything particularly wrong. It's only if you have the idea that because you do them, that makes you a good person. Or because you do them, that's going to be effective power in your life. No, it does mean that. If I have a door and it has a lock, if I don't have a key, I can't get in, you know. So some doors take keys and some doors don't. Some things we can enter in easily, and some things we need a code. You know, and what we call codes are to understand certain principles. And when we understand how the principle of a thing, how it works, then we can gain entry. So as we sit for this next 30 minutes, I'd like to take you in to that part. I'd like us to continue that part of meditation. All of this is before we actually get to actual meditation. So you might sit, depending on how well you can assess or examine yourself, you might sit for half an hour before you start. You might sit for half an hour before you actually start sitting, before you enter into the practice, because you're going through the preliminaries. But what if you were going through the preliminaries all the time? If you were constantly examining, you know, nowhere to run, nowhere to hide, in every moment of your day, you were looking, you were paying attention to what you're doing. I forget the Sutta number, it says two kinds of thoughts. You can put it into this category or this, that one, wholesome or unwholesome, beneficial or not beneficial. You know, you're not judging yourself, you're just observing and seeing how it is. After a while, you know, sooner and sooner, that thing I said, I didn't have to say that. That was just me being me. That thing I said, that was me, you know, being passive aggressive, because I'm too chicken to just tell them what I have an issue with. So I have these ways of saying these little things, or, you know, and you start to see right away, and then how could I correct that? Well, having the courage to just be honest and sit down with someone, if I feel that we have a disagreement and that I can't overlook it, maybe I can talk it out with them. Maybe I'm thinking they think something that they're not even thinking, you know. Or maybe I could think that if they're being passive aggressive with me, that maybe I can't expect them, if they're too chicken to sit down and talk to me, then maybe I should, you know, become passionate enough to sit down and talk with them. I can't expect them to fix something that's broken if they're afraid, you know, so maybe I'll be the one to sit and speak with them, you know. So, but this is how we learn how to govern our lives, how to develop ourselves, and how to elevate our mind. And that's all we have to do to wake up. This is called waking up. And it's so wonderful to know that it's not all the things that I thought it was when I first entered the monastery. It wasn't the touch not, taste not, handle not. It's why do you touch it? Why do you taste it? Why do you handle it? Does it lead to your happiness? Not just momentary happiness, but long happiness for the long haul. Does it lead to, yes, you say, yes, it leads to mine. Does it lead to the other person's happiness? Well, no. Well, then how could you modify what your idea is that leads to the happiness for you and the other person? See, this is where we live. This is our, whatever your address is. This is home. This is where we live. 24/7 with every breath that we take. And it's not glamorous, you know, but it's the truth. And so our lives get sweeter and sweeter, and we become clearer and clearer. It's sweet in the sense of it's unimpeded, you know. It's unimpeded. And then this life takes on a kind of brilliance, so that, you know, there's this Tibetan saying that if the Buddha jumped into a lake of fire, you know, or lake of swords, or it, they would turn into blossoms or something like that. And that's because of his own mind and how he sees the world, how she sees the world. And in that sense, we could say then the world is as we see it. The conditions that we are creating, their first thoughts in our mind, whether they're thoughts of harm, or whether they're thoughts of helplessness, or whether they're thoughts of happiness and assistance. So as Buddhist practitioners, we need to really begin to cultivate right? Really begin to cultivate. It talks about wise attention in the sutra that we'll close with tomorrow. Wise attention, what should be, what we should focus on, and what we should not. And you'll find that it's very little that we have to focus on, just whatever we think is good. Okay, so I think now until lunchtime, we will go back into a meditation. And I'd like to take you into this one. And it is a kind of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of mindfulness, but it's really reflecting on the brevity of life. It's really reflecting on the fact that we will definitely die. And you could kind of think of karma, it's not like a billy club, it's not like a punishment, it's not like anything. It's just simply like when you are committing an action, whether it be one of thought or whether it's one of speech or whether it's a bodily action, that everything that goes with that in terms of intention, the fruit of that is co-arising with it. It's not like you do something and then something happens. It's like whatever I'm doing, the truth of what that is rising with the action. And so I may commit the action and the fruit may not have ripened simultaneously. Like if I'm driving 90 miles an hour and there's a barricade up front and I don't have time to stop, then the action and its fruit, they're going to arrive at the same destination at the same time, right? But sometimes we do something, we don't find out about it until 9 months later. That fruit comes 9 months later. So all the time, every action and its fruit does not mature at the same time, but they do come into existence at the same time. That's what I'm saying. And if we understand that, really understand it, we'd be careful about what we do in secret. We'd be careful about what we think and how we think, if we really believe that. And if we don't believe it, we'll do whatever. But if we really remember it, that's what I'm saying. Sometimes we believe it, but we don't remember it because our senses are so trained to engage in actions that bring us momentary contentment. You know, and that's where the discipline comes in. Also where the clear seeing comes in. Because when you clearly see it, like you take a person who's been like in a codependent relationship, they ever get free of that? Mm-mm. When they run fast as a horse when they can smell codependence, you know, and they'll turn in the other direction. But until you see it, you don't see it. And these ways of training ourselves to constantly look without judgment, just recognize, you know, and when we are recognizing but not judging, it makes us more willing to look and see and recognize. Sweetening the mind at the same time, causing unarisen wholesome states to arise while we're subduing arisen unwholesome states. This is the path. Can everybody do this? Yeah, I think so. I think so. If it's simple enough, if we understand what we're doing, we understand why, if we understand the end game, the goal, the promise of the goal, And then we won't take too many sidebars. We won't vector off so much. And you'll find that we will be so useful. When we end tomorrow, it's gonna tell us about how we could be useful way more than we possibly think we can. You know, that it's not gonna cost us an arm and a leg and a shirt and our life and our happiness, but actually we're wired for it. And we're ready for it. So just get comfortable in any position you like. I know we talk about certain things like, you know, like don't lay down, don't have your camera off when we're doing talks, let us communicate. But if you're within the sound of my voice right now, that's all. That's enough. I had a master, her name was Chan Mo. And Chan Mo had a big old lazy boy recliner in the Dharma hall for her. We had hard pillows on the floor, but she had this huge lazy boy recliner. And when it was time to meditate, she'd get in that recliner. And I said, I'm gonna get me one of those when I get grown. When I get my own Dharma center, I'm gonna get me a lazy boy. and then I remember when it started getting too difficult, I'm in my 70s now, to sit in a chair, because from a child I wasn't acclimated to sitting in certain positions, but I was just trying to look Eastern. That's what we do, right? I mean, that's how we're gonna, No, but I realized that I was hurting myself. And then as I started sitting in a chair, boy, did my meditation start taking off, because I wasn't fighting. You know, the Buddha tried asceticism. He tried starving himself, whipping himself, you know, standing on one leg for hours and hours, all these kinds of things to, you know, flagellation, just punishing the body. He said, that ain't right. He said, I realized that was not the way. Yeah. So find a way that's comfortable for you to just sit. As we go into this preliminary practice, and then we'll settle. Just taking a deep breath in and out. And taking another breath in and out. And then just breathing naturally, normally. Thinking back over the years of your life, however many that is. I'm 71. It's a little difficult to remember all of those years. But I can tell you, it doesn't seem like it's been 71. Life moves so quickly. Life is like a dream. Was it just yesterday that I was 20 and in love? Was it just yesterday that I was 25? And I'd fallen out of love and in pain? Was it just yesterday I was 30 and in love again? Was it just yesterday I was graduating from college, ready to just go out and capture the world? Was it just yesterday I was 35 and disillusioned with what the world offered? Even making a lot of money, but finding no satisfaction in the work. Was it just 40 that I was confused and I'm asking, what's it all about? Seems like it was just yesterday that I was 55 and I discovered the Dhamma. Seems like it was just yesterday that what you fill in the blanks. Had my first child, had my last child. Won the lottery. Finally began to not have expectations of what my life should be, who I'm gonna be and what I'm gonna have. That I stopped looking at my neighbor and trying to keep up with the Joneses, that I started looking at my neighbor and trying to keep up with the Joneses, that I finally made good on that promise that I abandoned those habits in me that I detested, that I so quickly the time has come up, and now I find myself at X age. And how when I found the Dhamma, I was so excited. I was sure, absolutely sure, that I was going to achieve enlightenment in 7 days, then 7 months. It's like I could give 7 months, then 7 years. That's not that long. And now, 10 times seven. And I'm still thinking that it might be possible to attain if I wasn't so confused. But he said that it is simple, it's not easy, turning away from our habitual tendencies, being willing to give up our views and our ways of seeing the world for a higher way to see and know and understand. But yet something keeps driving me towards that. And that might just be the budding seed of my Buddha nature, my intrinsic nature, who and what I really am. Not the phenomena I'm presenting as in this present incarnation. So I realize I must use this time wisely. If I'm going to be saved, I must save myself. And if I hold mind, speech, and conduct as important, if I hold precepts as vows that I make to myself, if I want to enter true Buddha Dhamma and carry out all good, I must start now. Now is the moment. Right now. What did I do yesterday? I may not have thought before this talk. I may not have considered them actions of goodness or actions of unwholesomeness. And I like to say evil because it just makes it plain. gives it a little bit more punch so that I have no excuse for myself. With this vast mind that recognizes I don't need to have an excuse, I can just see it for what it is. This kind of radical internal honesty sets me on the path of true accomplishment. And pleasure, a kind of pleasure that the world doesn't give, so the world can't take it from me. And having thoroughly examined myself, all hearts and minds settled, I can truly enter into a stillness. Having abandoned both grief and covetousness for the world. So I'd like to close out this session with an homage to Shakyamuni Buddha. I think that was queued up, Cheryl, for coming back in. But if we could close on this, I think it's that's feeling more appropriate. It's okay, no words. We can just listen to the chant. In gratitude to our teacher.
Oh, blessed one, Shakyamuni Buddha, precious treasury of compassion, bestower of supreme inner peace.
Sister, can you turn it down a little
you
bit?
You who love all beings without the source of happiness and goodness, and you guide us to the liberating path. Your body is a wish-fulfilling jewel. Your speech is supreme purifying nectar. And your mind is
refuge for
all living beings.
With folded hands, I turn to you. Supreme, unchanging friend. from the depths of my heart, please give me the light of your wisdom to dispel the darkness of my mind and to heal my mental continuum.
Please nourish me
with your goodness,
that I in turn can nourish all beings with an unceasing banquet of delight through your compassionate intention.
Your blessings and virtuous deeds, and my strong wish to rely upon you.
May all suffering quickly cease.
And all happiness and joy be fulfilled. See you after lunch. After lunch will be more dynamic in case you eat a big meal.